Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, closing arguments and final shots from the campaigns this week, and millions turn out to vote early. In Florida, on Wednesday, Barack Obama told a crowd and a national TV audience they faced a choice on Election Day.
In 6 days, we can choose hope over fear and unity over division, the promise of change over the power of the status quo.
Same state, same day, in Tampa, John McCain painted electing Obama as a risky proposition in a dangerous world.
The question is whether this is a man who has what it takes to protect America from Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and other grave threats in the world.
And early voting numbers surged across the nation. Broward County High School student Siobhan Moore waited in line in Florida to cast her ballot and proudly wore her "I voted early" sticker afterward.
Of course, I'm proud of my sticker. I voted. I'm 18. I get to vote, and I have a voice. I feel like I have a voice in the country.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you still deciding how to vote? Are you one of the millions who has already voted? How's it feel? And can McCain still close the gap? Joining us today from Washington is Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine and writes for the magazine's Swampland blog. Karen Tumulty, great to have you here.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Washington, Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor for the Wall Street Journal. He writes the paper's weekly Capital Journal column. His latest book with John Harwood is Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. Jerry Seib, thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jerry, and Karen.
Well, can we believe it? The last week, the absolute last week. Karen Tumulty, when you look out across the landscape this week, what catches your eye? What matters in this last week of the campaign? We've seen so much already.
You know, I'm already getting nostalgic for this election. We've been living it now for 2 years. Yeah. But, you know, of everything that I saw this week, the thing that struck me the most, you know, it's a cliche in politics that it all depends on turnout. But I was looking at some of the polling that we've been doing for Time CNN polls in some of the battleground states. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by the fact, by one little bit of data, and that was that in both Missouri and Georgia, our polling data showed that John McCain was slightly ahead in the polling among so-called likely voters, which mm-hmm. are the sort of traditional people who show up all the time. Mm-hmm. But among registered voters, Barack Obama was ahead by a few points, which suggests, you know, that if in fact turnout is as huge as some people are predicting it's going to be, that really could swing some states.
Likely and registered, it starts to sound like a fine distinction, but you say if they really pour out, and they've poured out in pre-election day voting, that might favor Obama. Jerry Seib, you're looking at these poll numbers as well. I mean, there has been a temptation in certain quarters to say it's over, Obama's got it. John McCain saying very loudly on the campaign trail this week, don't you believe it, let's go. How do you read it, Jerry?
It does depend who shows up to some extent. I mean, I guess the Obama campaign probably has two problems. They don't have a lot of problems because things look pretty good, but they probably have two problems that should be worried about this weekend. One is the danger of overconfidence. If people think, well, he's going to win, it doesn't matter if I show up, then they don't show up, and that is a problem. The second and the big question mark that's hung over this campaign for months now is how much of the young vote will actually show up. I mean, if you look in the polls and if you parse them carefully, you will find that a lot of Barack Obama's advantage, in many ways, his entire advantage, comes from young voters, 18 to 29-year-old voters. That's where there's a huge surge of support for him. But those are the people who are least likely to actually show up and vote. They vote in much lower percentages than older voters do. So will they be there or not? That's a very important question today, tomorrow, through Tuesday.
Jack, how do you see it? I mean, the polls, when you look at them, they've still got that Obama lead in there. Of course, it's turnout on Election Day. Is that a surmountable gap, Jack?
Well, you know, you look at the numbers from 2004, and in Florida alone, there were, according to Jerry's paper, there were 600,000 registered African-American voters who didn't vote. There were 900,000 young voters who were registered who didn't vote. Now, is that going to be improved this year? Everybody says it will be, but that is the imponderable, it seems to me. There's a million votes right there that didn't turn out for in 2004. But it does seem to me that if everything holds up as it looks now, we as a people are on the verge of something wonderful. Electing an African-American president of the United States. I say wonderful because it's rare. It is unprecedented. It is historic. And I think that's what, for all the sordid nature of this campaign and the smear and fear, that is quite a remarkable – this is a remarkable moment, and we're right there on the edge of it, and it looks like it's going to happen.
Jerry Seib, wonderful, and perhaps will happen, but you write this week that the racial factor could also still cut the other way and may still be invisible in polls.
It's almost certainly invisible in polls if it exists, because people don't tell total strangers, least of all pollsters, that they harbor doubts about voting for somebody of another race. I just don't think that's something you pick up in polls. It may be absolutely no factor at all. It may be that the country's moved beyond that as a factor. It may be a factor that helps Barack Obama because, after all, a huge African-American turnout is a racially inspired vote as well. And there undoubtedly are many whites who want to vote for an African-American candidate to show themselves and the country that we've moved beyond that being a problem. But there undoubtedly are some, and nobody knows how many, whites who just in the end will not be able to walk in and pull the lever for an African-American candidate. But is that a few? Is that a middling amount? Or is it a whole lot? I think that's an imponderable.
The big media event of the week, of course, was the event that Barack Obama pulled off because of all the money that he has collected. A 30-minute infomercial Wednesday night on CBS, NBC, Fox, and more, just blanketing the airwaves. Half-hour extended campaign commercial. He did his best to sell his message of change, his style, to the American people.
With each passing month, our country's faced increasingly difficult times. But everywhere I go, despite the economic crisis and war and uncertainty about tomorrow, I still see optimism and hope and strength.
Karen Tumulty, what did you make of this unprecedented half hour of national television, almost wall to wall? You almost could not escape it, and something like a quarter of Americans watched it. What did you make of it, Karen?
It was really remarkable. It was like a roadblock on TV. You couldn't get around it. You know what I was struck by was how hard the campaign was sort of trying to reach out and make this message about the voters. Because, you know, we saw kind of the life stories of individual Americans mm-hmm. from various walks of life. One thing that the Obama campaign has been criticized for is making this campaign too much about him. And so you could really sense they're trying to kind of overcome this one last barrier for him. And I thought it was a really effective, piece of work here.
Jerry Seib, a kind of whole wheat bread commercial, amber waves of grain. You just couldn't get away from it, working very hard to be moving, but not offensive.
No, although, you know, what struck me the most was that I felt like we were back in 1992, and it's the economy, stupid. If anybody had any doubt what the Obama campaign thinks this campaign is about in the end, there was no question. It wasn't about, as Karen said, it wasn't about Barack Obama making people comfortable with his background. There was a little of that, but not very much. It certainly wasn't about national security. It was entirely about the economy. I thought it was interesting that all the people who had sort of touching economic stories happened to live in swing states. That was kind of convenient, I thought. But that's really...
That's why they call it showbiz, Jerry.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, it was very well done, and in that respect, among others. But I think it showed that the Obama people at least have figured out they have one message, and it is the message at the end, and it is middle-class economics.
Let's hear John McCain's message in response to that half-hour infomercial. McCain released his own 30-second spot proclaiming that the Democratic candidate was flash, not substance.
Behind the fancy speeches, grand promises, and TV specials lies the truth. With crises at home and abroad, Barack Obama lacks the experience America needs, and it shows. His response to our economic crisis is to spend and tax our economy deeper into recession. The fact is, Barack Obama is not ready yet.
With the dark clanging bell behind, Karen Tumbley, what do you make of John McCain's message in the last week in response to the Wednesday's 30-minute Obama commercial and beyond?
Well, the problem for John McCain, I think, is that he's had so many messages in the last week. There's the experience message, but he's also been, you know, calling Barack Obama a socialist. He's been calling for the Los Angeles Times to release videotapes. It's such a scattershot message. It really feels desperate, and it feels flailing.
Jerry, why should that be? I mean, we read about the many messages of John McCain in the New York Times last weekend. But still, this is a man who's been around. He knows what his core message is, one would think. He's represented himself in campaigns many times.
Well, but he's never had this situation before. And I think that they made a decision over the summer, late in the summer, that they were going to move away from an argument that said, I have the experience necessary to lead and he doesn't, because they wanted to seize the change argument. They thought, as many people did, that was the only message that really would work this year. And so he decided, and you saw this at the Republican convention, to match Barack Obama as an agent of change and to say, I'm a maverick, that means I change things too. And they kind of lost the experience argument. Interestingly, in our polling over the last month, the experience factor has been the one that has been the biggest advantage for John McCain and the biggest area of doubt about Barack Obama. So they've kind of veered back to it toward the end. It raises the question of maybe they would have been better off if they had stayed on that argument a little bit more all the way through, but they didn't.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the last week before elections, with Gerald Seib of The Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. Here's Sarah Palin, VP candidate on the trail for John McCain, accompanied at times this week by Joe the Plumber himself. At a rally in Indiana on Wednesday, she praised Joe the Plumber for uncovering the truth, she said, behind Obama's policies.
Barack Obama calls that spreading the wealth. Joe Biden calls higher taxes patriotic, but to Joe the Plumber, it said to him, it sounded like socialism. And now is not the time to experiment with that. They do that in other countries where the people are not free.
Gerald Seib, that was quite a roar in response to her socialism line. How do you feel the McCain-Palin attack on Obama's tax and economic policies working? Is the socialism critique really getting traction out there?
I don't think the socialism critique really works. I think the tax argument has had some bite to it, actually. I think that has worked to some extent. I mean, Joe the Plumber is being overused, obviously, but it was the first time, the appearance of Joe Plumber, that the McCain people figured out a way to articulate their counter to the Obama middle-class tax cut message. It was essentially, this is a redistribution program. We're taking money from people to give it away to others, and that's the problem with it. It's not just that it's going to raise your taxes. It's going to raise your taxes to give the money away to other people. That's the essential argument, and they could never figure out a way to articulate it until Joe the Plumber came along. I think that has actually done the McCain campaign some good. I think that Joe the Plumber was around to help them articulate it was the only way they broke through, but I don't think socialism quite works as well.
Jerry, your paper today, The Wall Street Journal, the lead story is banks owe billions to executives, and it says that the banks that are being bailed out by the federal government, by the taxpayers, owe more than $40 billion in past year's pay and pensions to their top executives. It makes it sound as though taxpayers may end up paying multi-billion dollar payouts to Wall Street executives. That hardly sounds like redistributing the wealth down to the socialist masses, Jerry.
Yeah, there's a backlash developing on this. And, you know, one of the problems is money is fungible. You put it into a bank and you say, you use this money to start opening the credit spigots again. You can't be sure that's really where it's going. But you can sense anger on this front developing. And it is a political issue. It's going to be a political issue that we'll be talking about next week, regardless of what happens in the election. And Congress is going to do something about it. The question of how you actually audit monitor funds that you're giving away in a rescue package, call it a bailout if you want. It's a very tricky one, but politically it really does matter.
Jack Beatty, I heard you there.
Well, I was just going to say that on pollster.com this morning, they have an analysis of this Joe the Plumber trope, and they find that Obama had a 10-point lead on whom do you trust on taxes before October 15th when Joe made his appearance, and he still has that lead. So that's to their metrics, it doesn't seem to have made any difference. The Times poll today says it has made a slight difference. But when you look further into the study that pollster.com does, they find that the people who most strongly disagree with the idea of the progressive income tax, that wealthy people pay at a higher rate than the less wealthy, are overwhelmingly affluent Republicans. And as you get down the income scale, the views of the progressive income tax change to the point where once you're beneath 75, and certainly when you're beneath $50,000, people think pretty well of it.
I guess logically they would. Still, McCain is really pushing on this point. Here he is in Dayton on Tuesday, whipping up a crowd by suggesting that some of Obama's past comments suggested that the Democratic candidate favored an unfair redistribution of wealth.
It means taking your money and giving it to someone else. He believes in redistributing wealth, not in policies that grow our economy and create jobs. He said that even through lower taxes on investment help our economy, even though it helps that, he favors higher taxes on investment for, quote, fairness. My friends, there's nothing fair about driving our economy into the ground. We all suffer when that happens.
Karen Tumulty, I want to get your angle on this. I mean, on the one hand, we've all seen the numbers for years now about the sort of dizzying inequality of American income. It's the distribution's gone quite the other way to the top, and the economy driven into the ground. The numbers are all out. Everybody's seen it. It's in the ground. So,
Well, Tom, as you suggested a minute ago, I mean, it's really hard to make this redistribution argument when both of these candidates just voted for a $700 billion bailout of the financial system. It is hard to make this argument when both of these candidates just supported the federal government buying ownership stakes in the biggest banks in the country. I mean, that is, you know, some people might call that socialist. And even, you know, if you even go back as far as the first couple of rounds of Bush tax cuts, which John McCain opposed. One of the reasons that he opposed them, he said then, was that they were unfair because they were too beneficial to the wealthy. So it, you know, this is an argument that he is making now that stirs up the base, as you just heard. But I think that up against kind of the larger context in which the country now finds itself, it's an argument that just doesn't take you very far.
Jerry Seiber of the Wall Street Journal, David Brooks writing in the Times today, conservative columnist, saying we need an enormous investment in national infrastructure. It sounded to me kind of along the lines of what Barack Obama has suggested. Do economists think that an Obama-style big federal investment in infrastructure would drive the economy into the ground, or is that is that how you pull it out when you're in the dumps?
It's an interesting debate, and it was interesting that David Brooks, clearly a conservative and an economic conservative, mm-hmm. would buy into that idea. That is, in fact, the crux of the debate going on in the background of this campaign about what it is Congress ought to do if it comes back after the election and concocts a second economic stimulus package. Democrats would like a lot of that to go to things like infrastructure spending and aid to the states. That does, in fact, stimulate the economy. The question is how quickly. And the counterargument that Republicans make is you're better off if you want to stimulate the economy, and they also believe this is a matter of philosophy, if you just get the money directly in the hands of consumers, that's the best and fastest way to stimulate the economy.
The counterargument being that people buy stuff made in Walmart, made in China. I mean,
exactly.
And that it doesn't
stick in the economy. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Let's go to Kenny in Heartland, Vermont, hear from our listeners here. Kenny, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
Pretty well. What do you think, Kenny?
I got 2 points I'd like to make. Number one is, before we declare this election over, I think we all need to remember that the polling in the past two presidential elections were terribly wrong. I can clearly remember Susan Estridge sitting there in 2004, all but declaring Kerry the winner, and we all know what the actual outcome was.
Right.
And my second point would be, kind of directed towards Jack, would, you know, Barack Obama spent $600 million to get elected. It's just an obscene amount of money. I could be elected with that kind of money. Anybody could be.
Kenny for president.
Never. My point here is, though, I, you know, it's terrific that he's black, but it really, is he qualified? That's the main thing here. Just because he's a black presidential candidate does not automatically make him qualified. And I think what you're going to find when people walk into the voting booth on Tuesday, they're going to have this question in their mind. You know, I think it's terrific that he's black. If he was a qualified black candidate, or any other candidate, you know, Chinese American, Irish American, it doesn't matter. The idea is he qualified. And I don't see that he has any more experience or qualification than Sarah Palin does. And I think John McCain is far more qualified than any of them, including Joe Biden.
Kenny, we've got it loud and clear. Let us pick it up. Jack, I'll come to you on that. But first, just to be very clear, Jerry Seib, first to you. I don't think anybody's saying here that this is over. You explicitly write this week. You write in the Wall Street Journal, the reality is, with just days to go in the U.S. presidential race, nobody knows for sure. Let's just be very clear on that, Jerry. The poll question that Kenny raises.
Nobody knows. I don't think anybody who says they know what the racial impact is telling you the truth, because I don't think anybody knows. And the reality is, and I did an exercise a week or so ago in which I went back and looked at polling from mid-October versus final results in every election since 1980. And the reality is they usually get closer in the last couple of weeks because undecideds tend to move toward in many cases they've moved toward the Republicans, sometimes they've moved toward the incumbent, but they tend to move in one direction, and that tends to close down the race.
But of course, it's not the last couple of weeks anymore. It's just the last handful of days at this point. But
in 1980, the big move was in the last 48 hours for Ronald Reagan. So big moves can happen at the end.
And Jack, you hear Kenny's honest question. What about the qualifications? He's still asking, says with $600 million, he could be president. He calls it obscene.
Yeah, and it is obscene, and I agree with him. And I think that Obama has, as John McCain says, public funding for campaigns, it's just unlikely, unless something serious is done on that, that any presidential candidate will accept the limits of that again. So that's a clear detriment to the whole cause of campaign finance reform. And I don't feel that just because so much of his contribution comes from, you know, small donations, that answers the question. It doesn't. There's a good deal of bundling in there, too. So that worries me. On the other hand, Kenny, what about the personal quality of the man? Have you seen in public life a more lucid, a more consistently intelligent and rational politician? He's been exposed, you say experience, he's been exposed to almost 25 debates. In all of those debates, he has had to speak across the great range of problems. And I defy you to name one problem on which he has not produced lucid, rational thought. Then you say, well, that's just talk. Well, then how has he behaved? I think Bill Clinton really zeroed in on that in Florida this week. How has he behaved? Look at his behavior. He named Joe Biden his vice presidential pick. And by nearly 20 points, the public says Biden is a better choice than Sarah Palin. John McCain picked Sarah Palin. And the second point that Bill Clinton made was, look at how he behaved in the financial crisis. He was steady. He was calm. He simply stayed with what the Democrats had been talking about. We have to put conditions on these loans and so on. And what did John McCain do? Well, I go to George Will, a conservative. He said his behavior was, quote, operatic. Rushing to Washington to save the day, and making a complete hash of that and being humiliated when the House Republicans couldn't follow his lead, if he had a lead to follow. Those weren't presidential actions. So I think in this theater of the last few months, we've seen Obama, it seems to me, act presidential and John McCain operatic.
And yet, Karen Tumulty, you can also read plenty of people saying John McCain has long experience in Washington, during which time he has proven that he would work across the aisle. People not so sure Barack Obama necessarily would actually do that in office, Karen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that John McCain is had a lot of appeal, and I think, you know, that John McCain would have done better in this presidential race. But the John McCain that we see in front of us now is the one who's you know, standing there and veering this way and that, and, you know, resorting to things like calling Barack Obama a socialist. So I think what people thought they knew about John McCain and what they see in front of them this moment are two different people. And while this was a, you know, traditional textbook, generic Republican campaign for president, I think they are ill-serving with this campaign strategy a Republican candidate who was not a generic Republican. I really think that the John McCain came into this race with the, you know, one of the strongest brands in politics. And at this point, I think that brand is significantly diminished.
Jerry raised race in the polls. Barack Obama was asked about that this week on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Obama discounted fears that his campaign would be affected by the so-called racial or Bradley effect. Here we are.
The polls have you up, but then they keep talking about this Bradley effect, this idea that white voters, when they go to the polls, they'll tell pollsters they're going to vote for an African-American, but they won't actually do it.
Yeah, they've been saying that for a while, but we're still here. So I don't know. I don't think white voters have gotten this memo about the Bradley effect.
White voters maybe haven't gotten the memo, says Obama on The Daily Show. Let's go to Bethany in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Bethany, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you see?
I was just curious about what your panel thinks. Since Barack Obama has been so grassroots, and I've been out there actually campaigning for him as well, talking to people, and he has brought so many people out of the darkness, really, to come out and vote. How is that going to make us feel, especially after the ramifications of the last election, the popular vote versus the electoral vote? What is the aftermath of that going to be?
McCain victory and Obama victory?
Exactly. If McCain does win, you know, how is that going to affect voters in the future after we've pulled so many people out to come out and be a part of it?
Bethany, thanks for the call. Karen, it's an interesting question, and it's no longer some distant, just sort of rhetorical question. I mean, this is next Tuesday night, maybe, or next Wednesday, we'll have one result or another. There have been voiced concerns about what may happen in the case Obama's not elected. Also concerns about backlash if he is. How do you see it, Karen?
You know, I guess I don't worry about it that much. I remember people raising this exact same sort of thing about Howard Dean, who mobilized all sorts of young people and brought all this enthusiasm, and then his campaign came for naught. And people said, well, these young people are never going to want to get involved in politics again. Well, guess what happened? 4 years later, they sure did in even bigger numbers. So, you know, I think, you know, elections come and elections go, and candidates excite people, and, you know, people will come back to the process.
You don't think this excitement's a little different? I mean, I have a friend in Chicago. He said if Obama loses, you know, white folk, you better hang an Obama sign in your window.
Well, look at all the people who in 2004 were saying that if George Bush won, they were going to move to Canada or move to Australia. I mean, I didn't exactly see,
right.
You know.
The flights weren't that crowded.
Yeah, people tend to talk one way before an election, but, you know, afterwards, the country survives.
Jerry, what do you say? Cool on the other side of one way or the other outcome?
Well, I mean, if John McCain wins, it's because there will turn out to be a wave of people in places like southern Ohio and central Missouri and maybe even in Pennsylvania who show up for him. So there will be a wave of people on the other side by definition. I think the scenario that has the potential to be ugliest is if there's a lot of disruption at polling places and people think folks weren't allowed to vote on one side or the other. That's the thing that I think could create some really nasty feelings.
I'm Tom Asprog. This is On Point. The Comics got their last campaign digs in this week, and the Phillies took it home. David Letterman talked about the weather, sort of, last night.
It's a little cold and windy outside, isn't it, today? Here's how cold it is. It's so cold today that Sarah Palin was putting chapstick on a pit bull.
Oh, boy. Conan O'Brien jabbed Obama's 30-minute TV ad.
Barack Obama aired a half-hour infomercial to attract more voters. Yeah. Yeah, and apparently if you watch the entire infomercial, Barack threw in a free set of Ginsu knives for you.
long. And Wednesday night, in a game delayed by rain for 2 days, the Philadelphia Phillies won their first World Series in 28 years. Harry Callis called the final out.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball.
Everybody loves to say that. Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Ray, calling from Lansing, Michigan. Ray, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The point I want to make is I'm an independent voter. In the last election, I voted for George Bush. I'm African-American, so I probably doesn't fit the conservative constituency that much.
Okay.
But I consider myself a moderate.
Okay.
And I've decided this time I'm voting for Barack Obama. And it's not because I'm black, but many people, when I tell them that, they say, well, oh, you're voting for Barack because he's black. And I'm not voting because he's black. I'm voting because I believe in his policy positions. I also believe that we've had a chance to see him and learn about his character over the last almost 2 years. If you watch the debate, you watch the way he's run his campaign, he stayed on point. He hasn't gone negative character assassinations against McCain or Sarah Palin. His attacks have been mainly on policy. And that's why I take issue with McCain and Palin.
But, Ray, what about the charge raised that he's going to redistribute the wealth? You call yourself a moderate. You voted for George Bush. Are you worried about Barack Obama's potential economic policies?
It's a great point. And I'm not concerned about it because it's not redistribution of wealth. It's a graduated tax policy. We've always had that policy in America. Well, we've had it for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's taking those tax rates back to the time that of Bill Clinton. And you know during those years, those were boom years for the middle class. And I'm not a person that believes in trickle-down economics. I believe that the economy is strong when the middle class is robust. And that you don't have to worry about wealthy people during that time, because wealthy people, when you have a robust middle class, the wealthy people get wealthier.
Hey, and Ray, let us just check in with you, since you're calling from Michigan. At this point, McCain or Obama, do you think anybody can save the big U.S. automakers?
Well, it's a big problem that we have here in Michigan. I think we're going to continue to lose jobs. We have to find a way to bring other types of industry here to Michigan. And I think Barack Obama investing in infrastructure will help do that. And we have an opportunity to put people to work in renewable energy sources, change our economy from a dependence on Middle Eastern oil towards, building our own infrastructure in this country to create jobs that won't be shipped overseas. I think that's a great point that Barack makes. I think he's more in tune with the middle class, and I think he's what we need to pull ourselves out of this terrible situation that we find ourselves in today.
Ray, it sounds like you've got a full platform, and we thank you for calling. Let's get one from Des Moines, Iowa, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My statement is about Republicans and how for years they have persuaded poor people to vote for them. And I think with right-wing conservative radio, they have hit on this point time and time and time again, and I think that's over. I hope it's over. And
do you know how you're going to vote, John? It sounds like you do, or have you voted already?
Already voted, and that was my next point. It did not dissuade me from voting for a black man when I walked into that poll. I was proud. Believe me, I was proud, and not because the man is black, but because he's such an intelligent, well-read. He's my hero.
What about our caller Kenny in Vermont, who says, fine, but he doesn't have the experience?
Who does? Who walks into that Oval Office with experience as president? Nobody does. And there's a lot of experiences in life that can prepare a person for this type of challenge. And believe me, we have some challenges. This is not going to be a picnic.
No,
for
not.
Whoever wins the election.
Yep, there's no doubt about that. Let's get one more. Christine in Nashville. You're on the air, Christine.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to just comment on how the media seems obsessed with the race issue. And I'm disappointed, I have to say, Tom, that you would repeat your friend's comment that if Barack Obama doesn't win, that white people better put a Barack Obama sign in their window. That's probably one of the most incendiary things I've heard said, and that it's coming from your show is a little disappointing.
Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's what he's thinking and saying. He's a longtime Chicagoan, and this is coming up in a couple of days. It's worth it's simply out there, I'll say.
Well, I think, you know, the history of this country would show that, you know, that the African-American people don't react with anger to the great disappointments that have come their way. But I worked for the 06 campaign in Tennessee, which Harold Ford Jr. ran in. We never talked about race. Every time a national publication came into town mm-hmm. and wrote an article about us or did a piece, the first five paragraphs of that article was about the racial dimension of our race. And we didn't see that. We were out all over Tennessee, and that is not what people talked about. And I worked for that campaign, and I've worked for Barack Obama's campaign. That's not what people are talking about. They're talking about other things. It's what the media talks about and obsesses about. And then it unfortunately badly affects African-American candidates because people think
right.
that they're the ones who are bringing it up all the time, and they're not. We never once brought up the race issue in that campaign in 06. In every single national article, that's what it wrote about.
Christine, you're very compelling. You're very compelling. Let us pick it up here. Karen Tumulty, you've done so much reporting. Is it the media that rides race into town when it comes to ask about what's going on? Christine worked for Harold Ford Jr. She has that feeling in Tennessee.
Well, I think that, you know, it is history staring us in the face. So we, you know, it's impossible not to write about it, impossible not to think about it. And it is one of the great unknowns of this election, which, by the way, it was also one of the unknowns in Harold Ford's election as well.
Lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. That's right. And so, yeah, I can absolutely see her point. And yet, you know, it's impossible to cover this race without taking note and trying to assess the fact that if, in fact, Barack Obama is elected, you know, the country will be, you know, going somewhere where it simply hasn't gone before.
And you hear our caller from Des Moines saying how proud that thought makes him. And yet, Jerry Sepp, I can't help thinking, when you look at the national situation, I mean, just start with the economy and tick right on down all the fronts on which this country is beleaguered right now. In some sense, it's remarkable that this race is still as close as it is, never mind who the candidates are.
Yeah, you can argue that the race should be over by now because of the incredibly awful terrain this is for Republicans in general. And it's not. And maybe it'll all break for Barack Obama. He'll win by 15 percentage points and it'll be a landslide. That's a possibility, too. Again, you're left to believe polls or not believe polls, I think. I guess I would argue that on the race question, it hasn't been a huge obsession of people in this campaign. It's come up. It's inevitably coming up at the end because we're now down to the question of, you know, will it affect undecided voters in the end? That was inevitably going to be a question. Frankly, if Hillary Clinton were the nominee, we would be asking the same question about a female candidate, just simply because we've never been here before. The question hasn't been answered because nobody's ever had a chance to answer it, and that will happen this year.
Let's go to Peggy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
There was a statement by Sarah Palin shortly after she was nominated or went with Mr. McCain. And she said if Russia attacked Georgia again, we would have to declare war on Russia. And
I guess you're talking about the Katie Couric interview. It was sort of words to that effect. Maybe not quite that straightforward, but that suggestion.
But basically, mm-hmm. that's what she said. And I'm sorry. I don't want a warmonger in the White House. I want to get out of war. I want to bring our men and women home. We don't need more war. You know, and that just scared the devil out of me.
So how will you vote, or have you voted, Peggy?
I have already voted in Iowa. We can vote early. And my vote is cast for a man that I have heard say, we need to get out, and we need to get out now. We need to formulate a plan and bring our soldiers home. And that's Obama.
Peggy, we see what's driving your vote, and thank you very much for that. Let's go to Rock Hill, South Carolina, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I have a question, and maybe I need some additional information on the on the issue of qualifications and or lack of experience, what amount of total autonomous power does a president really have? I mean, what president would do anything of consequence or accountability without first seeking his advisors? Should our choice be made on a personality or on the panel of advisors that he seeks out before doing something of any consequence?
Well, George W. Bush has taken a lot of steps. You don't see power in the actions that he's taken, war and otherwise, in the last 8 years?
Well, yes, certainly, and that's exactly my point, is that I don't think any president makes any decision whatsoever without seeking some advice from someone. He doesn't wake up in the middle of the night, have an idea, and make a public policy without passing it by someone.
So who's going to be in that inner circle? Gerald Seib, what do you say to Steve? He's wondering about Obama's inner circle, if it should be him, and for that matter, McCain.
Well, I think it's a legitimate question, and I think you look at people who surround a candidate in a campaign, and you get some answer to that question. But in the end, you know, it is the candidate slash the president who makes the decisions. You know, we all in the journalistic community dine out on stories about how the president's advisors have disagreed with each other on this, that, or the other thing, and ultimately there's one decider in chief, as George W. Bush said, and it is the president. So it does really matter, of course, and it's worth looking at, particularly now interesting to look at on the economic front. But in the end, there is a decider, and it is the president.
Karen, is it back to Clinton-era economic advisors if it should be Barack Obama?
No, actually, not necessarily. I mean, there are a number of them that we have seen in the picture this week. You know, Paul Volcker, we've seen Bob Rubin. But I think that Obama has a broader circle than that. And you look at the, you know, some of the advisors he had on domestic policy, people like, you know, Austin Goolsbee, an academic that I don't think any of us ever heard of before the campaign. He does have a broader circle than that. And, you know, I at one point heard Warren Buffett say that the thing that would be most enlightening, far more enlightening than having a vice presidential debate, would have been for both of these guys to tell us who their Treasury secretaries would be and then have those two guys debate. And I do think it's going to be interesting, whoever gets elected, to see, you know, this first few weeks, we're going to hear a lot of cabinet appointments, and that's going to tell us a lot about their direction.
Jack, what do you anticipate?
Well, you know, I think Steve raises a very good point. And when you look at John McCain's foreign policy advisors, it's heavily neoconservatives. It's heavily people who are in favor of the Iraq war. Now, is that a good signal or not? You decide. You look on the economic side with McCain. I mean, he's fired advisors. He's had in Douglas Holtz Aiken, he's had somebody who just seems to intimate that McCain had invented the BlackBerry, for heaven's sakes. And his economic policies have had a kind of improvised it's been one a day, it seems to me, from McCain. Whereas with Obama, you've had, you know, the consistent message right all the way through. And as Bill Clinton said, when the economic crisis came in early October, Obama talked to Buffett, he talked to Summers, he talked to Rubin, he talked to his economic people. McCain took a day out of the campaign and talked to his political people about what he should do. I think that's very telling.
Let's hear from John McCain. Barack Obama had a half hour on Wednesday night. John McCain had Larry King, CNN's. Larry King asked him if he was worried about being behind in the polls. McCain, fighting on here.
Obviously, I know we're still the underdog. We're now 2 or 3 or 4 points down, and we got 6 days to go to make that up. But it's not a matter of worry. It just, you know, you and I have been together long enough. You know, I love the underdog status. I just want to leave that status about the time the polls close.
Once eventually not to be the underdog. Karen, Gerald Seib, you have followed this campaign for so long now. When you cast your mind back 18 months, a couple of years ago, could you have imagined these two men in this array at this point in the election? Karen, did it jump out to you from that great big crowd of contenders in the primary season?
Well, I am embarrassed to admit that the first story I wrote in this cycle was about Hillary Clinton and John McCain, and I posited the idea that John McCain would be a really strong general election candidate but would have trouble getting through a primary.
Whoops.
And that Hillary Clinton would be unstoppable in a Democratic primary but could have problems in a general election. So my predictive abilities should have been pretty bad this election cycle.
We won't kick you out for that. Jerry, what do you say? Cast your mind back.
Well, I think what the Karen scenario could have happened very easily. Mm-hmm. We were all at one point convinced there was a Hillary Clinton juggernaut, and there wasn't. Obviously, there nearly was, but there wasn't. I did think all along that John McCain was the strongest Republican that could be nominated this year, but because I thought he would run a different campaign, I thought he would be a Republican who would be seen as breaking the mold in many ways and who would appeal to what I think is a mood in the land that says let's get beyond the partisan warfare that sort of seems to have overtaken Washington in the 1990s and beyond. And it hasn't felt quite that way. But, a lot of people wrote President Giuliani stories, and those are probably buried now as well.
And here we are with just days to go. It's been a long, long season. And, Jack, as you point out, one way or another, history made on Tuesday, and maybe very, very big American history.
Maybe epical American history. And symbolism matters, doesn't it? I mean, really, it does.
The Economist magazine putting Obama on the cover and saying from across the pond in London, kind of conservative economist, let's go this way. The whole world truly this time watching. Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine, always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thanks, Tom.
Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal, co-author of Pennsylvania Avenue. Read his column, Capital Journal. Jerry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here. Happy Halloween, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
Woo! I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.